Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
It's 30 with Murdy with your host, Sweeney Murdy.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back on this episode. As baseball sits in the middle of a work stoppage with the end not currently in sight, we have a conversation with former big leaguer Rico Bronya on a number of relevant topics. Bronya, a first-round draft pick in 1988 by the Tigers, played 9 seasons in the majors, mostly with the Mets and Phillies, but also briefly with the Tigers, Red Sox, and Braves. A slick-fielding first baseman with a lefty power stroke, in the 1990s, Bronya had 4 seasons of 20 or more homers and 2 seasons with 100-plus RBIs. Physical toll of a degenerative spinal condition ended his career in 2001 at age 31. Bronya has spent the last 20 years in various roles in sports. In addition to managing, coaching, scouting, and player development for several organizations, he's also worked as a high school and college football coach. In 2014 and 15, Bronya was an information coach with the Angels, helping Mike Socia utilize and disseminate analytic information to the players on a daily basis, pretty common position on coaching staffs these days. In 2021, Bronya managed the low-A Stockton Ports in the Oakland A's organization, and it was there that he saw firsthand the positive effects of a pitch clock and what it could mean to the future of Major League Baseball. And it just so happens that in the most famous and destructive work stoppage in baseball history, the 1994 strike that canceled a World Series and leaked into the next year, Bronya was a young player rep in the union. It's here where we start his perspective a quarter century later on that strike and on this current MLB lockout. Bronya offers thoughts on the young player's mindset, the unified front of the player's union, and a somewhat surprising take on what the union wants most to get younger players into the higher end of the pay scale faster. And it just so happens that Bronya played with a couple of potential Hall of Famers who are currently on the ballot. We'll discuss that too. For thoughts on all that and more, here is my conversation with Rico Bronya. Rico, the first thing I want to ask you is, now that we're into January, you know what the feeling is like being a player who's in a work stoppage with spring training a month away. Situation was a little bit different because the players were on strike in 1994-95. So yep. You had some control over the situation, so to speak. Right now it's an owner's locking out the players situation. So there's a difference, right. But in general, what are players feeling right now as you're sitting in January and you're starting to get that feeling, you're starting to work out, you're starting to get your body ready for spring training. And a month from now, you want to be in spring training, but there's a lot of uncertainty, especially with unsigned players too. But just this feeling in general of a player who doesn't know if he's going to get to start spring training in a month.
Yeah, it's a very awkward feeling. There's no doubt once you turn the corner, once those college football games are played on January 1st, even though that's extended now to a championship game, but usually right after New Year's, literally like today in the calendar, on the calendar year, you're starting more baseball activity. You know, pitchers are starting to play catch again. Hitters might go to the cage. You know, up until that point, it's a lot of healing your body and then starting to re-strengthen it and get it ready physically. Once you turn the corner of New Year's, I know generally speaking, most players go about it that way. So I don't think they'll change right now. I think that whole thing will stay the same, but that cloud, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, above their head of what's going to happen, especially if you don't have a team at this time, is definitely not fun. And athletes are good at blocking things out and really just focusing on the task at hand, or at least the good athletes are. So I think the good ones will still just go about their business and anticipate. But that said, Sweeney, I mean, this thing could be long. I think they've been getting ready, both sides, for this fight for years now. So whether that could be good, that they could come to an agreement because they've been preparing, or it could be that it's going to be, you know, pretty much a battle. So we'll see. But
if you think back to 1995, in January, you guys had already been on strike for 5 months already.
Right.
The postseason had been wiped out and everybody was kind of in this like nuclear winter kind of thing. But again, this is a player's strike that back then. So it was a different situation a little bit. What was it hard as you were talking to people because you were a player's rep? Was it hard to maintain this united front? Did you get a sense that there were cracks in the union at that point?
Well, that was the whole deal for us. Again, I think big point you brought up there, Swain, about, you know, this is being locked out compared to a strike. I mean, that is one of the reasons I think the owners did that is because they want to give players the leverage of a strike. Anyway, it's a strategic, tactical, whatever you want to call it. But there is a difference. There's no doubt, you know, I was an assistant player rep and then worked toward being player rep in both New York with the Mets and in Philadelphia. So I got to be on some inside meetings and it was a fascinating educational process. And then I've worked in the front office. So I've seen kind of both sides of this whole deal. But from the perspective of a lockout slash strike from a player's rep point of view, and I don't know, I think the whole thing about leverage is important. Who's got the, we always thought about who's, you know, who's got the hammer, so to speak. And the players don't have a lot of hammers. Using that analogy, really striking is one of them. And the owners basically in a strategical move took that away. But if they go to court, you know, they can complain, well, we got locked out. So there's still a lot of things going on. That going back to the, were we divided, which is your central question. Sorry, I got off on a tangent there. We got very united under Donald Fehr because he brought us together consistently. And then he got the teams together consistently, made sure we had calls all the time. And he was quick to point out that the only way we don't get something accomplished is if we break, if we get fractured, if we divide. And one thing that they capitalized on that I'm sure they're trying to now on the player side so they don't fracture is take advantage of the competitive spirit of an athlete. Almost put it in the form of a competition. Because when you compete as a team with one goal, and now you're all together, we're not playing the Yankees, playing the Red Sox, playing the Mets, we're all one, and that's 800 to 1,000 guys or whatever. Man, that's what kept us together and strong. Now, we got, this is a long story, but we had, I was in the meeting in Florida. They had the meeting in Florida, and we had the other half in Arizona, players back then. And I was in the meeting in Florida with the Mets, you know, one of the representative when there was a big thing with the Phillies fallout, like when Lenny Dykstra got up and spoke, you know, we should give in or give in to these certain things, not give in, but give in certain ground, certain areas that eventually the players all understood that would fracture us completely. I mean, there was World War III right in front of us. I mean, I never saw players get so fired up at each other. And in about a half hour, 45 minutes, become so united. Really? So, you know, Darren Dalton, Lenny Dykstra, the Phillies crew were kind of on their own, but at the same time, and I became friends with all those guys. So they were great guys. Nothing about that. Mm-hmm. It's just that they quickly realized, oh no, I got to get together with the entire players aren't all here. And they were at the end of the day, very competitive and very much wanted to be part of a team. Long way of saying that's what the owners will definitely try to do is divide them.
How divisive is the salary structure within the players itself? I mean, in 94, 95, you're a young player making around league minimum, and it wasn't as big a gap then. The highest paid players were making probably like $5-6 million. Now you got players making $30 million. You got players making, you know, the league minimum it's a big gap.
Yes.
And there are a lot of players and I'm sure their families who are saying, mm-hmm. you know, are we really not going to have a paycheck in a month or so? Like, yeah, what's pressure. How is that dynamic?
Well, it's a great point, Swain, because there's pressure. It's another way to, you know, get a little bit of try to get the players to fracture, divide, if you will. Now, the owners, in my humble opinion, not knowing anything, I'm not tied into anything this time around, just seeing it from the outside. They gave a lot of big contracts, a flurry of them in the last couple of weeks, right before it went on. Well, that does a couple of things. It says to the courts, you know, we're paying players. I mean, they're getting paid. And it's granted, it's only a handful of guys, but it's big bucks. And then at the same time, now those players want that money. They right. didn't sign that deal to not get it, mm-hmm. right? It's $30 million. They could say, well, I could give up some, but now all of a sudden, if you strike or lock out and you prolong the whole process, you know, those are big dollars that families are not getting. I mean, you know, the key for us way back then was they did a great job, the Player Association, of putting some money away. So we got some money from time to time, and it was purposely put in away in the pot for that, you know, for that reason. So again, I'm not on the inside right now knowing those particulars with the players or the owners, but there's no doubt that there's a lot of educated people on both sides of this process. Tony Clark is great, brilliant. They're, you know, and Manfred, they're brilliant. So they've used all these experiences, the Lords of the Realm, going back to that book, right? I think it was the 1980s or
49. Got it right here.
Okay. I mean, terrific read, by the way. You know, anyways, that this is a situation where they've gone to school for 50, you know, more years. And there's so much money. You could say, look at it two ways. The players want, you know, all that, all their contract money, the families do, but they have enough where they can give some away. So there's kind of that give and take. Both sides can make all these quadrillions, you know, billions of dollars, trillions perhaps with media. But that also makes them want more of it. So there's really the same old argument. And the general public, you know, the fans, it's just not going to be, they're really going to have a tough time seeing what the two sides see.
Do you remember, did the union leadership and the older players at the time find a way to explain to you as a younger player not making a lot of money why you were in this fight and why it was important for you to stand your ground, even though you weren't in the same situation as, I don't know, like David Cohn, Bobby Bonilla, whoever's making money back then?
Yeah. Another great point. Yes. And I had that history and traditional, you know, most young players, or at least they should be brought into their game by the veterans with all they've been through being poured onto them, the young guys. And I got that. Maybe it was because I was fortunate enough to be in big league camp at age 18 and 19 with Alan Trammell, Jack Morris, Lou Whitaker. I mean, go down the line of veteran, Chet Lemon. I mean, you could, Tony Phil. I mean, go down, you know, this veteran team in Detroit with Sparky Anderson as the manager. So this was like in the late 80s, early 90s. And I was just out of high school. And those guys were really in it. They were still getting checks from the previous settlement.
Collusion,
The collusion settlement. And I was in the locker room in spring training when they were getting handed $200,000-$300,000 checks.
Wow.
Lump sum. And I'm going, what's that? You know, I was in high school the year before playing high school baseball in Connecticut and, you know, football. And these guys, I'm in a locker room now with guys getting $250,000 checks. I'm like, what's that for? But they explained to me what it was for. This is earned. This was not just a free gift. Mm-hmm. This was collusion from going back to that book of Lords of the Realm, you know, with the free agents. So anyways, long story short, or as short as possible, Swain, they taught me those lessons. They were quick to teach me those lessons. And they made sure that if it ever happened with me being a veteran player, that I was going to pass it along. I mean, they would do it with force. They would tell you, you need to do this. Like, this is not an option for you as a player. You have to pass this down. Every generation of players has gone through too much to make ground.
I wanted to ask you what it's like being a player rep from this perspective. You have a job to do for yourself, for your team and your family to get yourself in shape to play and be in the best possible physical and mental condition to play. There is a certain amount of stress, I would imagine, involved with being a player rep. And at the time, you know, 25 years ago, it's not an email chain or a text chain. I mean, you're physically picking up the phone and calling everybody and keeping everybody right. And having, you know, what, 25 or 40 different conversations every time right. something happens. What kind of impact is that for the people who are charged with being leaders for their union, for their particular team? How much stress did you feel?
Yeah, well, you know, the benefit, the great thing about back then, it was very personable, you know, very more intimate amongst the teams and players with the calls. You heard voices or you went to meetings. Stories were told about what players have gone through, and you heard their voice and you saw their faces, and it was very together. There were very few barriers, if you will. Anything that the Players Association, Don Fear, and the nurse thought could bring a team together, players together, unite, so that, you know, there wouldn't be division, was, I think, utilized fully. And I think the whole thing was personalized, like, because I was making, you know, maybe 110,000, say, for minimum salary at the time. And, you know, Bobby Bonilla is making, you know, multi-million dollars. Mm-hmm. And we had Saberhagen and the Mets making million, you know, and I'm making minimum, but I was also hitting third in the lineup, you know, having my best statistical season. So the players looked to me as a young guy with a future, a possible future in the game. Mm-hmm. Of being that guy we're doing this for you, but they did it with their arm around you. They did it with, it was kind of like in a huddle, you know, if you will, like a more of a personal huddle. And again, it really comes back to, there's only a few times you have the hammer. The players have it. If they get divided or fractured, it's over. It's over. I think that happened, actually. I think that, you know, the owners have gotten way too much over the years. I mean, that's a personal stance, but sure. The crack was opened. We won't tell anybody we're going to randomly test people. This is like last year or two of my plan. We're just going to test, and we're going to test 150 players, and it will be random, and no one will know. Within like minutes, the names were leaked to the, you know, all the world. Mm-hmm. And people had to go in front of panels, and I was like, whoa. So as soon as you allow, you know, we knew it. We have fought it. Don't do it. Don't give them an inch, because that thing will, you know, that door will barge wide open. And it did.
Something you said a minute ago really leads me into what I wanted to ask you about next. You were a young player who, as you said, had a bright future, but physical issues ended your career at age 31.
Yeah.
One of the big issues right now is trying to get players played in their 20s, because free agency, it's rare for players to get to free agency before
to get there
and make that money. And now, you know, all the numbers tell you don't pay players beyond age 30. So
Right. Players
are stuck in this little middle ground here.
Sure.
Is completely legal, but now Right. You're trying to make a system that benefits the players who are producing at a younger age. Right. So from your perspective, how important is, as a guy who, you know, you produced a great deal in your, say, mid-20s.
Yep.
By age 31, your career is over.
Over, yeah.
How important is it of an issue for you when this is the crux of what the players want, to make, you know, to get to arbitration earlier, to get to free agency earlier, or to keep from being boxed out beyond age 30?
Right. Well, it's a great point, because I see the merit of having to pay your dues, you know, perform year after year after year until you get paid. Maybe after 4, 5, 6 seasons, you might get a multi-year deal. If you keep performing, there's a lot of merit to that, because you have to earn it. And I think, you know, if you get paid before you really, you know, earn it, if you're getting paid, you're earning it. But if, you know what I'm saying? Like, if you have not yet put 4, 5, 6 seasons, consecutive years together of just playing 150 games and per doing it, you really haven't proven yourself yet. So I knew that I was personally speaking, that I had a year-to-year deal. I didn't even know if I'd be able to play next year, any year. Mm-hmm. So I had to really go all out, try to play, do whatever I could, you know, to play the best and most games, the best I could every year, every game, every night. And I think that benefited me in the long run. And I don't think there, let me just say this one. I don't think there are a lot of good ways to explain guys getting paid out of the chute. There really aren't. There really isn't. And this is more maybe leans toward, you know, management or whatever, but there really are not many. If you don't earn it, you change. I've just seen it. You just, I mean, do you want the money? Yeah. If you can get, and you're going to pay it to me. Okay. I'll take it, you know, as a, obviously, but you got to stay hungry. And there's no, hey, we're going to be honest here. There's no doubt those big contracts keep you, you know, that are just around the corner. They keep you hungry. When your wife, you're now you're married. Now your wife's pregnant. Now she's pregnant again. Now you want, now you have a mortgage. Okay. As you go along in your 20s into your early 30s, these things are reality. And you see the light at the end of the tunnel or next year, or the year after, if you keep playing well and you play hurt and you play every day and you play with passion, you play to win, that you get paid for that. That edge can never, if any of that edge is taken away, you will not be as good as you can be. So I, that's just, I mean, that's another way for me to say it, but.
Yeah, it's interesting because I almost, and I didn't ask you this ahead of time. I kind of you'd be on the other side because your opportunity to earn money was with your performance in your mid 20s. So, you know, everything you had to do beyond that, you know, because your career got cut short, I would have thought you'd have been on the other side.
Yeah, it's kind of backwards. And then just being on, like, it's kind of backwards. I mean, don't get me wrong. We tried to ask for a couple multi-year deals and just kept getting told no. And I said, all right, you know, no, because I understood, you know, I had a health situation where the teams didn't want to invest long-term, perhaps not able to get the insurance taken out on me. It's like an automobile that's, you know, so I you know, yeah, I would, I could understand where that would be. Okay, I got to get it now or I might never get it. But I also, you know, there's a, just an athlete's a different, you know, there's the competitiveness, there's the, you got to play with a chip on your shoulder. I mean, I got the Patriots t-shirt on, Brady's still making everyone pay for being the, not what pick he was, the 199th pick. That is his chip. I mean, he's got other chips on his shoulder, but that always, I'm going to make you pay for not picking me. You know, for all those rounds, and he just keeps doing it year after year. There's a, there's an edge. An athlete has a legitimate edge. Some guys try to manufacture it and make, you know, fake, but the, if you get paid and you didn't do it yet, and you didn't really, you can't, you know, if you've earned, you know, when you look around the league at other players and you say, I really haven't done what he's done yet, what he's done yet, what they've done yet. And I'm getting, as you know, you take the money, obviously, but you lose a little edge.
I, you know, the financial aspect is one major component of the negotiation right now, but there's another thing that's about the game on the field. I don't know how much of it's going to be addressed before they get to some sort of a settlement, but you're a good guy to talk to about this because you managed last season the Stockton, the A-ball affiliate of the Oakland A's. And you got to use some of these experimental things that we might see moving forward eventually. Right. Let's start with the pitch clock. Okay. You saw it and I saw it. I read, I didn't think I heard it, but I read the interview you did with Jason Stark. And you know, you were a big fan of what this created. Why?
Loved it. Loved it. For every reason, loved it. I mean, I was a, the kind of player that liked to be playing, you know, behind a pitcher like a Schilling in Philly, who worked fast and threw strikes. Maddox. And when I was in my last year in Atlanta, it was like the games were over before the sun went down in the middle of summer. You know, it was like the sun's still setting behind home plate. But that was fun. Like to the analogy would be more like a pressing fast break basketball game or a no huddle football offense where players in motion, athletes in motion tend to like to stay in motion, keep the pace going, and they perform better everywhere. Offense, defense, their mind is sharper. They're off their feet. They're on and off their feet, you know, quicker and more often, so they can preserve their health is better. And there's just, so anyways, this forced, one thing I was trying to do is like a, when I was for a minute, a field coordinator and a farm director, one of the things I tried to implement, Sween, was our pitchers to stay in this before shot, you know, we have the shot clocks now, like you're talking about, to stay in the rubber, hitter, stay in the box. So in the minor leagues, we were going to tell our guys, this is kind of what we're looking for before there was any clock, because we thought there'd be benefits. I saw all that. I loved it. You know, there was not, it was fast, but you know what it made you do? It made you get your less signs from a third base coach. So you had to have more flash signs, more preparation before the game, which is probably the right thing to do anyways. Mm-hmm. And so when it happened in the fifth inning, you just go, you know, you just go, you just play. You can't take 20 seconds to get a sign from the third base coach. Mm-hmm. You're in the box, the pitcher's throwing, and it was fast.
But it aided offense, right? This aided the offensive part of the game.
Yes. Statistically, Jason Stark, he told me that it was a lot more than I thought at the time. I would have thought, you know, defense and pitching and stuff like that, but hitting is rhythm. You know, when you think about it, and you lose rhythm when you step out of the box, you readjust your gloves, you get a long sign from the third base coach, you take a deep breath, you do your gloves again. You've lost your rhythm. Tony Gwynn, go back to the clocks. When you think about Tony Gwynn in your mind's eye,
He
never left the box. He just stayed in there. Boom, stayed in. I mean, these good hitters just stay in the box.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
All right, so here's my other question about that. The hopeful benefit is a more entertaining product.
Right.
You were involved in the game and the strategy and the idea of winning and losing. And the thing I keep coming back to is that, you know, when you're on the field, you don't care if it's entertaining. Your job is to win. So whether it's a long, drawn-out game or a quick, fast-paced game, as long as you win, you're getting your paycheck to win, not to entertain people, so to speak, in a manner.
Right, sure.
But as you're watching, you're obviously involved in managing, but could you appreciate a more entertaining product in front of you? Did you get that distinction?
It was awesome. Every fan I talked to, the time between innings kept the fans in the game. But yet they still had enough time to go, you know, get snacks and a soda and a hot dog and come back. But you're going to miss a batter, maybe, you know. But it was 2 hours and 20 minutes of like fast break baseball. Mm-hmm. Now, I understand, you know, I wasn't a fan of clock. I'm old school. I didn't want a clock. I don't like the fact, you know, that scared me at the beginning. But what I saw was the entire game benefit. From A to Z, fans liked it, players liked it, umpires were solid. There would be nothing. The only thing I was worried about if players couldn't adjust, you know, like say six or seven pitchers would just, they get called a ball and now it's 3-2 when they, you know, it was 2-2 and they got called for, it's like a balk, you know, if you don't throw it in time. Sweeney, we had like, you know, two or three in the first, when it first started, which wasn't even a lot. And same with the other teams while our hitters were hitting. And that was it. The players just, I mean, you know, the players, if you just tell them the rules and you stay consistent with the rules, you don't change them. Like, you know, this was consistent. They learn. And all of a sudden players didn't even, it wasn't even a thought. It's too fast. It's not fast enough. Nothing. It was just, again, I think athletes like to be in motion. So, there was really there's no negative. I was like surprised myself. I felt that way because there was a clock out there, you know, but
one of the other things, I guess, you could speak to a little bit. I don't remember you hitting a lot of ground balls, but you're a left-handed batter. So, the shift, are you pro legislation, banning the shift? Do you want legislation banning the shift?
Yeah, I'm not for that. The stuff that really, even like the three, you know, the relief pitcher has to pitch three, you know, the lefty coming in, or you got to shift it. I think if you want to put eight guys in this shoulder to shoulder, you can do it, you know, but that's what you're going to give up something, you know, draft and develop different hitters, you know, well, we're all trying to hit home. Well, why, you know, okay. If you're hitting in the shifts, then in pro sports, the next person has to adjust. Pitcher does this, hitter adjusts. Hitter does this, pitcher adjusts. Defense. So I don't like being dictated or having it dictated how I would manage a game. If I want to bring in a pitcher for one batter, that's my prerogative. Now, but I'm wasting a roster spot.
Yeah.
Not wasting it, but, you know, he doesn't have much value otherwise. except for one left. So I got to make a set to get something. I'm also giving you something. I think when you start trying to manipulate players and how they would manage a game, how managers manage a game, even with the instant replay and stuff like that, how many things you can throw out there or not challenge and all that, you know, that changes the decision-making. Mm-hmm. You know, the clock is a different deal. That's like the whole game. You know, everyone's got this clock in front of them. We all play by it. The umpires umpire by it. Mm-hmm. And so no, the shift, I just say, be a good hitter. Be a good hitter first. I mean, you know, I mean, Charlie Lau, his first thing in his 10 fundamentals was be a good hitter first before power. Be a good hitter first.
All right. So that's going to lead me into this next one. You saw you had a year under your belt watching A-ball players last year. And, you know, I think one of the things that stick in the craw of people who consider themselves old school versus what you're seeing now and the product you're seeing now is that you're being taught, players are being taught how to swing and throw, not necessarily how to hit and pitch.
Yeah.
You understand what I mean?
Yeah. Well, very well said. Yeah.
Is that what you're seeing? And is there a way to fix it?
Yeah. I mean, it's very well phrased and said by Swain. I think there is a lot of that. Yeah, no doubt. They're not. I saw even our guys, low A, you know, with the Oakland A's this past season, managing our team, strikeouts happen and not be bothered by it. There are times when you don't might not be bothered by it. There are other times or a lot of times it should bother you. I mean, okay, we'll say, well, Reek's old, you know, he's 50, grew up then. These players are 30 years younger, and it's now. Yeah. Not really. I mean, the fundamentals of the game, if you don't tinker with the fundamentals, you know, and change a million rules, which might be happening, but you got to put pressure on the defense. The odds of scoring a point go up when you get to first base. They go up more when you get to second, and they go up more when you get to third. So when you take the if you really want to get statistical analysis involved, you got to get on base to score. Now you can launch homers, okay, but you know that's a very unpredictable. You know it's tough to determine in math. You get 30 of them a year. I mean, but when do they come? I mean,
and you're a highly analytical guy. I mean, this is part of your job with the Angels too. I mean, you dove into these. You're not bah humbug on the analytics.
Oh no,
you're all in.
I'm into it. Yeah, I'm into it. I mean, it's what part of the math are you into? So what I learned was okay, you win a game by scoring one more point than the other team. We play a game every day. So our job is to try to win that game that day. Not tomorrow, you know, we keep it in mind, but we're trying to win a game. If we're playing cards, me and you are playing chess tonight, Swain. There's a game. You try to win it, I try to win it. I don't want to lose, you don't want to lose. So that's the same thing. So what I need to do to win that game tonight is score more points than the other guy. And you stop runs, you know, preventative pitching defense, or you score them by getting on base and coming around. Now, a home run's a great way to score runs, and it's part of the equation. But I tried to find ways. You know, we had all these stats, but what were the important stats to us? And you know, and with Socha and we had players like Trout and Pujols, a great team, back in 2015, and you know, with the Angels. You know, made the playoffs, won 98 games. But that team was a get on base, move them first to third, occasionally launch, obviously. But Trout was more of a threat to hit a double in the gap and go first to third or score from first on Pujols' base hit or double. You know, that was how the team, when we pitched, caught the ball. It was a one-run team. I'm into the stats, but, you know, you have to decide what stats are for you. Otherwise, you're everything to all, you know, all people, and now you're not differentiating yourself from the opponent.
I'm going to get back to the managing thing in a second, but you know what, as well as I do, what January means in baseball, it's Hall of Fame season, right? A lot of discussion about the players in the ballot. It gets pushed deeper into the month now. It used to be the first week in January you'd find out, but they've made it an entire month's worth of news. And for better or for worse, this is what we discuss in January in baseball. And actually, one way it's better, I think every player on the ballot gets time to be digested and you look at, and there are players. I've always said this, Rico, I say, getting to look at a player and study his career is the reward.
We don't know who the automatic Hall of Famers are. You know,
great point.
You need a ballot to tell us that Hank Aaron or Willie Mays or Derek Jeter or whoever is a Hall of Famer, right?
Right.
But when you're looking at a ballot and saying, I wonder if Curt Schilling deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. I wonder if Bobby Abreu deserves to be in the Hall of Fame.
Yep.
When you study those guys, I say that's the reward
because every
player gets that. Not every player gets to have that breakdown. With all this in mind, Curt Schilling is a very divisive figure for a number of reasons. Putting that aside, you were his teammate for a few years, a few very good years in Philadelphia. I think you were there probably, even if you weren't within shouting distance, it was probably relayed to you the quote that Ed Wade had when he said that Curt's a horse at he's a horse the day he pitches and he's a horse's ass every the other
I was there, I think, for that.
So and nobody's ever disputed that was misquoted. It was, you know, I think everybody's understood.
I love playing with him.
As great a teammate, yes. As his teammate, what can you tell people?
Oh, great teammate. And, you know, you didn't want the ball in anybody else's hand in a big spot. He was, I mean, you know, you hear that and you say, but this was true. I mean, the bigger the moment, the brighter the spotlight, he was better. And he was good anyways, obviously, but he would come to me. This is a, you know, I got along with him great. And I, you know, cause we were very just guys that wanted to just win games compared where, you know, our focus was just, what can we do to be good on this team and help us win? And, you know, so we got along great. And, you know, and he actually got me introduced to some computer off on another tangent or story is he got me introduced to computers when it was kind of all starting, you know, in the 90s. So, and he was already making computer games. I mean, he's a brilliant, brilliant guy. Anyways, he would tell me, hey, if everything stays as is, you know, no rainouts, no, nothing gets in the way in about 10 or my two starts from now, I'm going to go up against Randy Johnson or, you know, I got saves. If three, my three starts out, man, it's going to be a great, me and Pedro up in Montreal. Right. I mean, he was on it. And that's how we thought. We thought, hey, next week in as hitters, next week in Atlanta, we're going to miss Maddux, but we're going to see Smoltz, Glavine, and you know, whoever you met, you're still going to get three Hall of Famers or two. Yeah. And that's kind of how the position players felt because Schill, in my humble opinion, great starting pitchers, I always thought were part of the team. Like a player was. Maddux was like that. I mean, he wanted to play shorts. If the days he didn't pitch, he was still on the field taking, you know, Schilling was out there taking ground balls, fly. He wanted to be like, they were in the game every day, love baseball. And Schilling was that guy. So he was always like, but he didn't miss any. He, again, to the spotlight thing, the bigger the moment, the better he was. That's, you know, he said, all right, and that, you know, Pedro in two starts from now, what that's going to be, the whole country's going to be watching that game. You know, he magnified it to get himself. He knew he was good in those big moments, but great teammate, really smart. He watched video. He's doing all that before other guys and computers. Brilliant. Even the stats, you know, the math, he just, you know, I can get a fat. If I can throw a fastball, if I can command a fastball away, they can't beat me. And he's just a brilliant guy who could simplify things. And, you know, that's why he was great. And he could execute.
I'm curious. I remember this. I saw this firsthand. I know my experience with it. I happened to be in the clubhouse pregame one day on a day he was starting. And I saw him come out of his locker. And he's not even like, he doesn't even see me or anybody else in his way. He's taking these giant steps toward me. And I had to move or else he was just going to run me over. That's the zone he was in.
Yes.
I know that's what he was like with media in the clubhouse. And it was good to media in the clubhouse. But pregame, day he starts, I know he's trying to ignore us. Is he ignoring you too? Can you converse with him or you just leave him alone?
Leave him alone. No, game day. You knew when he was pitching.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No. He was a different guy. I mean, he was in his locker. It was quiet. He was maybe video. He would maybe say one or two things about how he's going to pitch a player. And he went, hey, Reek, I'm going to pitch him in. You might want to play a couple steps pull side. You know, so we didn't even have to get the dot plots from the front office. Schilling knew how he wanted you to play a guy, which says something also. Mm-hmm. You know, great pitchers with command and control, they know their plan. They can tell players where to play. rather than getting told.
Right.
Pitch,
right.
Right. So there's something to that too. So he's a great leader, knew what he, you know, he could do everything, a game plan, execute it. And he was very focused on game day because he had taken all the, he'd internalized all this information and he knew he had to, when the output needed to be simple. So it's like a computer, you put all this stuff in there and, you know, coding and data, and you need the printout to be simple because I got to throw a pitch, you know, and he was focused. You didn't really want to be around him on game day until the game happened. Then you wanted, you know, because he was a gamer.
Another guy that's on the ballot that you were a teammate with is Scott Rolen.
Yeah.
And he's gaining some momentum. And I do believe that there's going to be a day within the next, I'm going to guess with sometime within the next 3 years,
wow, that
he's going to get his day. I believe, yeah, just based off of what we're seeing, and you know, the ballot's going to clear out soon and, you know, a brighter, yep, light will get to shine on him. The, yep, question I hear most often as a negative, as a reason people wouldn't want to vote for him or see him, yeah, in the Hall of Fame is, well, when you were watching Scott Rolen, did you really think you were watching one of the best players in the game? And,
right,
and I remember watching Scott Rolen pretty closely, 97, 98, 99, yeah, early, wow, in his career.
It's amazing, right? Yeah.
I mean, yeah, my answer is, yeah, yes. I thought I was watching one of the best player on the field and one of the best players in the game based on what he did on both sides, how he, yeah, threw his body around on that turf and still got up and performed, yeah, the way he did. You know a lot about that.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
I don't know what you think, Rico, but I was watching him saying, yeah, that's, yeah, one of the best players in the game.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think about what would have been like. I played against George Brett at the end of his career, third baseman. It was during his early years as a pro, could really run. He could play defense. He could hit. He could hit for power. He had a dynamic personality. He was a team leader. You know, so I think of George Brett with Scott Rolen, you know, kind of the same. Even Mike Schmidt, you know, I mean, just talk about Schmidt, he could run. He could play defense, hit for power, was clutch, was a leader. And definitely Rolen, you know, playing with him for the 4 years in Philly, I never been around a player with that kind of ability before. So I say yes. I mean, the only thing about the Hall of Fame is health is part of it. So it's like a Mattingly, unfortunately, I mean, he's a Hall of Famer, right? Don Mattingly or Scott Rolen. But if it's one of those things where maybe you're not that guy long enough.
Correct.
Because the health, well, then that's, if you're not on the field, you're not on the field.
Yeah.
And that's part of it. I understand that, you know, totally. But his ability, I mean, was, you know, the other players and the other teams, Swain, you know, when like back, we go down to the cage, we're playing the Astros and we're taking flips at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And there's Bagwell and Biggio, you know, and Ken Caminiti, as we're switching cages, they're hitting. And then we go to flip. We talk, we know each other, you know, it's the game's 4 hours from now. They're like that Rolen guy. I mean, when he was young, you know, in 97, mm-hmm, 8 and 9, he was still, yeah, young, mm-hmm, first, second, third year.
Yeah.
They just, I mean, guys like that, you know, the best players on the other teams were like, wow, that guy. I mean, the Braves, Chipper's like, mm-hmm, Rolen's a stud, dude. Maddox used to tell me, you know, Maddox is like, you know, so that's the biggest compliment when you get that kind of praise from other players. I just think, yeah, Hall of Fame. I don't know all the statistics. Again, I haven't looked at his, mm-hmm, I know basically, but you know, you got to be on the field for a long time. It's a combination. It's not just play for a long time.
Correct.
And it's not just a short, you know, Don Mattingly, maybe, mm-hmm, I love Mattingly, so I wish he was in, but you know, three more years of that. So it's an elite group. You made a great point. Just being talked about in the conversation is a great reward.
That's the reward. I tell people that a lot. But I feel like my other thing about Rolen is that he ended up playing long enough to attain.
Yeah.
Not, he didn't attain the automatic numbers,
right,
but he played long enough to get like his, he actually looks very similar to Edgar Martinez, uh-huh, with homers and doubles.
Uh-huh.
And you, yeah, added the fact, this is the other part. And you were a really good defender, right?
Oh, Scott was amazing.
You valued defense and you saw what Scott Rolen was defensively. I don't think, you know, we love to ding people for not being defenders. Like,
Edgar
had to wait because he was a DH only, right? Well,
yes,
Scott Rolen won 8 Gold Gloves and threw his body around like a full, like a linebacker playing third base.
Best I've ever seen by far.
Yeah.
I mean, you can, the great ones, there's other great ones. Yeah. And, you know, but there was no one better at playing third base. There just couldn't be. It's not possible to be better than Scott defensively. There just can't be that. You can't be better than that. I mean, you could be as good. And there were many that were in that same breath, or not many, but there's a few.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Nolan Arenado and, you know, Brooks Robinson. You can go to Mike Schmidt, even, you know, George Brett. I mean, there's no way. I mean, I can think about it now. There's no way I can even imagine anyone even being a whisker better than him at defensive third base, that loved to be that good, that couldn't wait to show you how good he was, yeah, and that thrived off making that play too, which, you know, that's all part of it. That's one of the reasons why he was that great. But his athleticism and tools, shortstop, playing third, you could throw it all out, whatever you want to say. I still have numbness on cold days like today. I'm showing that we're doing audio, but my index finger on my glove hand, you know, where I caught his throws, literally half of my finger will go numb today if I go outside in cold weather because of him.
Really?
I had to put pads on my glove, literally, you know, pads, double padded behind the leather because of one player.
Wow. You know,
Scott. Yep. Because he threw the ball like that.
All right. So maybe one day you'll get to manage a player like that and kind of marvel at it. But here's my last thing for you, Rico. Getting back to, you know, as I said earlier, you managed an A-ball this past
season.
And you've had kind of this weird post-playing career. Over the last 20 years, you jumped in and out of a lot of different things. You've been coaching high school football and basketball, college football. You've been, I think, like a hitting coach at one level, and then, you know, you've been in the major league level with the Angels. So majors, minors, college, high school, you've gone a lot of different places.
All over, scouting.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. And for a couple of different places, and for like a couple of years at a time. So my question to you is, now you're managing again.
Yeah.
Do you want to be a big league manager? Is there a level of saying, okay, I found something that I want to commit to, or that I think I can really sink my teeth into for the next however many years? There weren't very many jobs open this cycle, but there's going to be another cycle coming soon where, you know, 7-8 jobs are opening up.
Yeah. Opening. Yes, sir.
Do you
absolutely
want to be one of those guys?
Oh, I would definitely love to manage. Yeah. The next best thing to playing is managing. And it might even be, it's like, you know, it's obviously a little different than playing, but there's kind of nothing like playing. I mean, just, you know, playing is the ultimate, and that'll always be true. I suppose the big league level, I don't think that'll ever be surpassed, even though managing, you can probably come close. Mm-hmm. I love it. I mean, I find it fascinating. I love being a quarterback. I like coaching quarterbacks. I like, you know, that football part of things. Mm-hmm. Being a point guard, you know, kind of being a manager. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in Philadelphia, Sweeney, you were there, so you saw how good Terry Francona was with us as a manager and a player. He was personable, but he could put his foot down. He just had it. He had it. And he still has it, you know. And I learned so much from Tito, and I would love someday to have that kind of influence on individual players and a team as a manager, because there's only a few opportunities to do it. And managing is one of the few. I mean, they're impossible jobs to get, but I mean, think of the positive impact that like a guy, Terry Frank, whomever you can think of, Socha, you know, you go down the line, LaRusso, the ones that even now Buck Showalter's had such a great influence on player, you know, with the Mets, and Bobby Cox playing for him. But like, I see Tito and I say, I would love to do that. Selfishly, I would love to be Tito for 4 years managing a team. And I say 4 years, I do it forever. Yeah. But, you know, like I played for him for 4 years.
Yeah.
And the impact he had on me as a person and a player, more, you know, both, I guess, because you spend so much time together, you know, you carry with you for life. And I want to win a World Series. I want to win. Like, that is selfish. I want to win a World Series. I didn't do it as a player. Came close as a coach with the Angels. We made the playoffs a few years ago. But I haven't gotten a World Series ring. I want to win one. Yeah. I don't know how else to say it.
So when
there's going to be an amazing job. They're impossible to get, but coaching is great. I mean, nothing like managing.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. They're only 30 of them, you know, so they don't.
Yeah.
But there's going to be a cycle where six or seven of them open up at once. You want to get in that mix at some point.
Yeah. Right? And I've done a lot of different things. I mean, that's positive and a negative, you know, so you could say stick with one thing and go for 20 years. Or I've scouted, I've been that data, like Kotze, I did what he did. I did what Rojas did with the Mets. You know, all these guys I did, you know, Phil in Milwaukee, you know, like Council and stuff like they were before they managed. Seeing all sides of it, coaching, scouting, managing, playing. That's what I bring to the table, I guess, if I could, you know, pump it up a little bit here. But that also, I understand, you know, I've been in and out of things too. And I haven't been able to sustain value at maybe one position long enough. So I'm not ego isn't such that I don't see both sides of it, but I know one thing, like when I played, I want to win tonight. And then tomorrow I want to win that game, you know, so I'd take that same approach as a manager and would love to get a chance to do it. Just to be around a team, be on a team like that. There's nothing. A season with a team, especially if you get to be a manager, I mean, just being on a team is amazing, but that would be awesome.
My thanks again to Rico Bronya, who now at 52 possesses the playing background, the coaching background, and the analytic background to put himself in the mix for managerial positions in the near future. If you're new here, please check out the 30 with Murdy archive. Check out recent conversations like the one I had with filmmaker Andrew Bergman, whose works include the classics Fletch and Blazing Saddles. Also, my talk with Dennis Quaid, veteran of several sports movies, or my chat with Amber Sabathia, a baseball wife turned player agent. Check out all these episodes and more at Odyssey, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. Make sure to subscribe and review and all that jazz. And until next time, I'm Sweeney Murdy. Thanks for listening.
Baseball is back. Basketball is heating up. And the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.